Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Platz coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue, our School of Jewish Studies, where we study, among many things, on Tuesday nights, Tanakh Tuesday, First Kings. We are studying Malachim Aleph. We're in the kind of closing aspects of Chapter 10. And so without further ado, I hope your Shabbos and Shavuos was enjoyable, uplifting, and filled with Torah and mitzvahs and davening and good meals and all that. And I hope you had a really great yontif. Let's begin. We are in the Judaica Press Sefer on page 117b. We did not finish the footnote of last week. So let's kind of just do a little bit of a review, if we may. Nothing wrong with that. Okay, let's take a look at, let's just review back a little bit to verse 20, all right, verse 20, and 12 lines, I'll read it in the English. Verse 20, I'm in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 20. And 12 lions stood there on the six steps on one side and on the other. No such throne was made for any kingdom. So, let's take a look again at the footnote. We'll put everybody on the same page. We're on page 117. On one side and on the other. That is, six on one side and six on the other, says the Mitzvot David. The Malbim explains the symbolism of the throne as follows. The lions were the symbol of the tribe of Judah, of course, based on Jacob's blessing in Genesis. There were 12 lions in all, signifying the 12 progenitors of Solomon from Judah onward, including Solomon, or from Jacob until King David. And for that, you should see the book that we read over the Antif, see Book of Ruth, chapter 4. Moreover, Solomon's pool had 12 oxen, and his throne had 12 lions. These correspond to the Merkava, Ezekiel's vision of the divine chariot, also something that we read over the holiday, where four beings are depicted: an eagle, an ox, a lion, and a man. The water of the pool is symbolic of the divine attribute of loving kindness, whereas the throne is symbolic of the divine attribute of justice. On the other hand, the ox appearing on the left in the vision of the Merkava symbolizes justice, whereas the lion appearing on the right symbolizes loving kindness. Thus, each attribute softens its opposite, combining justice with kindness, and kindness with justice. We are doing a little review of last week, verse 20 and the footnote. That's a long footnote. We continue now, and we're on page 117b. Abarbanel sees the throne as symbolic of the kingdom. The dome was symbolic of its having been bestowed upon Solomon by God himself. The two lions standing on either side of the throne denote that the princes of the Torah, the sages and the prophets, shall reign supreme as lions. The two arms signify that the judgment will always follow both the written and the oral Torah. He sees the 12 lions as symbols of the 12 tribes, corresponding to the two onyx stones of the ephod, on which the names of the 12 tribes were engraved, six opposite six. Okay? The 12 lions are symbols of the 12 tribes. Very good. Esther Rabba states that the six lions signify the six heavens, the 6 days of creation, and the six special precepts that the Torah imposes on the king. They are as follows. 1, the king shall not have many wives. 2, he shall not have many horses. 3, a Jewish king shall not increase much gold and silver. 4, you shall not pervert justice. You, the king, shall not respect people. and five, that was 5 and 6, you shall not accept a bribe. All that is in Devarim, Deuteronomy, both chapter 16 and chapter 17. When Solomon set foot on the first step of the throne, a call arose admonishing, kings shall not have many wives. Didn't quite work for Solomon when he set foot on the first step of the throne. He kind of ignored that, but, you know, I'm not going to judge him. It's just that you maybe you shouldn't have 1,000 wives if the Torah says you shouldn't. Anyway, alternatively, the 6 steps represent the 6 orders of the Mishnah. Zeruim, Moed, Nushim, Nezikin, Kutchim, and Taharis. According to Midrash Abba Gurion, the throne was much more elaborate than Scripture alone indicates. This Midrash relates to us that there were 6 ways to ascend the throne, and each way had 6 steps, and on each step there were 2 lions. He would ascend by means of a mechanism. When the king would step down, the lions would extend their paws, 1 from each side. Biblical verses were engraved on their paws. He would turn right and he would read, "You shall not respect persons in judgment." He would turn left and he would read, "You shall not accept a bribe." And so on. Rather, and so on all 12 lions were written similar verses. Each step was paved with precious stones, some white and some green and red and crystal. Date palms surrounded the throne, enwrapped in linen, and peacocks of ivory opposite the eagle's the eagle's wings. I need some fresh air in here. Okay. Let's get some fresh air. Can't get enough of that sometimes. Okay. Very good. All right. Again, date palms surrounded the throne and wrapped in linen and peacocks of ivory opposite the eagle's wings and 2 marble pillars on the heads of the lions and 2 hollow golden lions from either side of the throne full of all kinds of perfume. Also, there were 2 chairs standing on both sides of the throne, 1 for God the Chosen and 1 for Nathan the prophet. Midrash Panim Acherim says, 1 for the high priest and 1 for the prefect. 70 chairs encircled the throne for the 70 elders. And that's where we ended off last week. Now we break new ground. On each, one each way, 2 lions and 2 eagles were standing, facing each other. When the king would ascend the throne, he would place his foot on the first step, and a wheel would turn in the mechanism. The lion would extend his right paw and the eagle his left wing, upon which the king would support himself and ascend the second step. He would stand on the second step and the wheels would turn. The eagle would extend his right wing and the lion his left paw, and so on each step. A silver peacock would carry the king through the mechanism and seat him on the throne, and the eagles would spread out their wings and would ascend by means of the mechanism and form a canopy over the king's head. Then a golden dove would come down from the pillar and open the ark and take the Torah and place it on his knees to fulfill what the Torah says, quote, "And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life." Pasuk in Devarim, Deuteronomy. Then a lion would extend his paw and take the crown and place it on his head. And all present would say, "May the Davidic dynasty reign forever." I'm on page 117C, if you've got the Judaica Press. On every step, there were clean beasts opposite unclean ones. On the first step was an ox opposite a lion. On the second step, a lamb opposite a wolf. On the third step, a kid opposite a tiger. On the fourth step, a deer opposite a bear. On the fifth step, an eagle opposite a dove. On the sixth step, a hawk opposite a clean bird. And he would ascend and make peace between them. On each step, he would read a verse. On the first step, he would read, "God's Torah is perfect. It returns the soul." On the second step, the king would read, "God's testimony is faithful. It endows the fool with wisdom." On the third step, he would read, "God's charges are straight. They cause the heart to rejoice." On the fourth step, the king would read, God's commandment is pure, it enlightens the eyes. On the fifth step, the king would read, the fear of God is pure, it stands forever. On the sixth step, he would read, God's judgments are true, they are consistent. Then Shlomo would be seated. I'm on page 117C. Then Shlomo would be seated on the throne of God, and the high priest and the Sanhedrin would come and greet him and be seated at his right hand and his left and discuss the law with him. When the witnesses would come before the king, the mechanism would snap, the wheels would turn, the lions would roar, the eagles would fly, the peacocks would chirp. This was done in order to throw fear into their hearts, lest they testify falsely. Because this throne was so remarkable, it was coveted by the surrounding monarchs. The first to plunder it was Shishak, king of Egypt, who attacked Jerusalem during the reign of Shlomo's son, Rehoboam. See 1 Chronicles chapter 12. He claimed the throne in payment of his daughter's ksuba. Wow. According to the Midrash, Shishak was Pharaoh, whose daughter King Shlomo had married. When Shlomo passed, his estate was responsible to pay the ksuba to his widows. Through this pretext, Shishak claimed ownership of the throne. Subsequently, Shishak declared war on Zerah the Cushite and lost the throne to him. Asa, in his battle with Zerah, retrieved the throne. From then on, until the conquest by Nebuchadnezzar, all the kings of Judah sat on this throne. When Nebuchadnezzar plundered it, he transferred the throne to Babel. From Babylonia, it was subsequently transferred to Media. From Media to Greece. From Greece to Rome. Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi, reports seeing its remains in Rome. Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus both sat on it. Ahasuerus was warned against sitting on it because he was not a cosmocrator. I never saw that word before.
A cosmocrator?
How else you pronounce it? A cosmocrator? No way. A cosmocrator. I've never seen that word before.
Oh, yeah.
A lord of the world. He therefore constructed a replica thereof. See Esther Rabba 1. I tell you, this Midrashim are always good for
something. Only cosmocrators can see, cosmocrators can sit on that thing or else.
You got to be a lord of the world. According to Midrash Abba Gurion, the Jews were not so fortunate. When Shishak captured the throne, it remained in Egypt until Sennacherib conquered Egypt and took the throne to Assyria. When he attacked Yerushalayim, he brought the throne with his armies. And when he fell, the throne, I'm on page 117D, when he fell, the throne was returned to Yerushalayim by Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyahu perceived in the throne's six steps an allusion to six kings who were destined to sit upon it. Shlomo, Rehoboam, Chizkiyahu, Amon, Menashe, and Yoshio. In Josiah's time, it was pillaged by Pharaoh Necho, who was unfamiliar with the running of its mechanism and was crippled by a blow dealt him by a golden lion, hence the name Paro Necho, the lame Paro. Welcome all.
I think Necho, maybe not spelled quite that way, is known from outside history the pharaohs.
Yeah. We're in chapter 10 of 1 Kings. And we are plowing through a very, very long footnote in the Judaica Press on verse 20. When Nebuchadnezzar conquered Egypt, he transported the throne of Shlomo to Babel, to Babylonia, where he attempted to ascend it to judge Tzidkiyahu. Israel prayed that he be unable to do so. Since he was unfamiliar with the mechanism, he too was struck by a lion and fell from the throne. Since this throne had been constructed by Solomon, who had been endowed with divine wisdom, it was known as Kisei Hashem, the throne of God. See that in 1 Chronicles chapter 29. Nebuchadnezzar the wicked was obviously unworthy of sitting on his divinely inspired throne. He was therefore thrown off of it. When the prophet Isaiah rebukes Nebuchadnezzar, he says, How have you fallen from heaven? See Isaiah 14, 12. Interesting pasuk to use as a source. Darius, Daryavish, moved it to Elam, but was afraid to sit on it. Ahasuerus attempted to duplicate it, but was unable to do so. His engineers, therefore, constructed a different throne for him. All that, see Midrash Abba Gurion and Midrash Panim Acherim, chapter 1. So that is a fairly long footnote for chapter 20, discussing the throne, verse 20 rather, chapter 10, verse 20, which had said, quote, and 12 lions stood there on the 6 steps on one side and on the other. No such throne was made for any kingdom. That's verse 20. And now we can go on to verse 21. Unless you have questions. But if you have questions, I won't be able to answer it because I don't know how the mechanism worked. And I wasn't there, and I just can't really imagine it. But people were getting injured. They should have been much more respectful.
They were user's manual.
They should have been in manufacturer's manual that goes along with it.
Kind of like the Ark.
The Ark.
Right. The wrong people get hold of the Ark.
They get hurt.
Yeah.
Right. That's true. Can't be going and touching the Ark. Verse, very good. Verse 21, Chaf Aleph. We have a shot at finishing this chapter today, but only a slim shot.
Again, Parakeet Pasuk, what are you?
Chapter 10, verse 21. And there are only 29 psukim in the chapter. So we can try it, but there are long footnotes along the way. We'll try to read them all out. So again, verse 21. Now we're going to start fresh material. Here we go. V'chol klei mashke ha-melech Shlomo zahav. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold. V'chol klei beis ya'ar ha-levanon zahav sagor. And all the utensils of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold, zahav sagur, pure gold. We're going to see that's like a cut above gold. Ein kesef lo nechshav bimei Shlomo lim'uma. None of these things were made out of silver, since it was reckoned as nothing. Silver was reckoned as having very little, if any, value. Everything was made out of gold. He had tons of gold. It was valuable. There was a lot of it, and so much so, the chol klei of ein kesef lo nechsha, silver was not reckoned over there. It had no value during the days of Solomon. Take a look. If there's a footnote on 21, we'll have a look at it. We can. Let's see. We do. We're on page 117D on the bottom. A small footnote. None of his utensils were made out of silver, since it was reckoned as having no value. Literally, there was no silver. It was not reckoned. That is, there was no silver in any of them, because it was not reckoned as having any value. So this is Rashi and Radak. So he never made any silver goblets. These days, you go into, you go into the, what is that? In Israel, Hatzorfim. What do they have over there? Aren't they silver plating the stuff at 92.5? Don't I remember that? Don't they silver plate the stuff? I think that they do. As noted above, Zahav Sagur, this phrase, literally kind of a closed off gold, what does it mean? Zahav Sagur. That's gold of the highest quality. Gold of high quality, which when offered for sale, causes all other gold exchanges to close. When you're offering Zahav Sagur, you're offering the best. And when you offer the best, that's all people want, and nobody wants anything less than that.
It sounds logical. It translated to the best quality, but they close all the exchanges because people who couldn't afford the best probably would still want to pay the somewhat lower prices for the other.
Way too rational for us over here. Way too rational. Over here, we're told that when it's offered for sale, causes all other gold exchanges to close. Wow, that's something. It says over here that if that's all people wanted. Isn't that amazing?
Once it's sold, then they can open again.
Uh-huh. Once all the Zahav Sagor is sold, then you're saying, then the other gold exchanges come open again, okay? I'm just reporting the news. Don't shoot this messenger. I'm just reporting. I know my brother is not. But he makes a good point. It's just that I don't know how to deal with it. I'm just reading over here. I got a footnote of some sort. Matsudas David, Matsudas Tion explains it is gold that is locked in a crucible to be refined. That's why it's considered or called Zahav Sagur, locked up gold, because it's locked up in a crucible. It's going to get heated up. It's going to get cleaned up and refined. The Abarbanel adds that although it was customary to use silver vessels at all state functions during Shlomo's reign, only gold vessels were used.
Wow.
Silver was worth nothing. Fascinating stuff. Okay, verse 22. Chaf Beis, Kioni Tarshish Lamelech Bayam, Imoni Chiram. Because the king, Shlomo, had ships at sea of Tarshish with Chiram ships. It's a little bit confusing. Kioni Tarshish Lamelech. The king had, King Solomon had a ship that was Tarshish, Tarsus related, at sea. Imoni Chiram, along with ships of Chiram, his buddy. Achas l'sholosh shanim tavo oni tarshish. No se zahav achesev shenahabim v'kofim v'tukiyim. Okay? Once in 3 years. Achas l'sholosh shanim, once in 3 years, the ships of Tarshish would come, and there would be no se zahav achesev. These ships would have gold and silver on them, and also Shen Habim says they're ivory. Kofim, of course, are monkeys. Tukiyim are peacocks.
Peacocks. That's later in Hebrew, I think they use it for parrots. That's very interesting.
Oh. Okay, so they're coming back with some very exotic stuff. Once in 3 years, they would come back.
Silver.
I'm sorry?
They're bothering.
And they're going out of their way to bring silver to a kingdom which doesn't really even need it. It doesn't really use much of it, if anything. Okay, good point.
That's for the commoners.
That's exactly for the commoners. I would definitely take some silver. I would certainly do that. Take a look at our footnote. There's another massively long footnote over here on ships of Tarshish. Now, the name Tarshish comes into the Western consciousness through Tarsus, and I thought that that's a small city in Asia Minor. Is it not that? Or we're told over here that Tarshish is in North Africa. Okay? Let's read the footnote and see what it says. I'm on page 117D. If you've got it, great. If not, I'll do the reading. Ships of Tarshish. Only Tarshish Lamelech. The king had Tarshish oriented ships. Ships of Africa, says Rashi and the Radak. And ivory and monkeys and peacocks were on those ships, which would dock in Israel, and once every 3 years, and unload ivory, monkeys, and peacocks. The Abarbanel points out that the ships that went to Ophir went east of Cush in Asia. I always thought that Cush was in, I always thought the Kush was equated with Ethiopia. So these ships would go to Ophir and they would go east of Kush. And when it says in Asia, I guess it means, maybe means toward Asia. I didn't know that Kush is in Asia. I thought Kush is in Africa. But you know what? Let's keep on going for now. Tarshish is in North Africa, it says over here. In ancient times, it was called Carthage. Well, everybody's heard of that. Carthage is a very, very famous city. Today it is called Tunisia, and it's on the Mediterranean Sea. Okay. I think that's accurate, right? Tyre, which is in modern-day Lebanon, right, was located on the coast of the Mediterranean and was a trading partner of Carthage. The prophet says to Tyre, the prophet Yechezkel says to the city of Tyre, the ships of Tarshish, talking about the ships of Tarshish, Shlomo, who had conquered Etzion Gever, which is near Eilat, which is on the Gulf of Aqaba, all the way south in modern-day Israel, sent ships through the Arabian Sea to Ophir. A couple of weeks ago, we read that there was a commentator who thought that Ophir was Peru, if I'm not mistaken. We thought that's a little bit difficult to understand, because to get to Peru means you got to go over the Atlantic Ocean. Then you got to go through, you got to go over land, over the South American continent, and find your way to Peru, which is on the left-hand side of that continent. It's a lot of land to get through. So we weren't quite sure if that was actually accurate. But it could be that Ophir is in a much more accessible place and not over the Atlantic and then over the whole South American continent to get to Peru. Therefore, again, Solomon, who had conquered Etzion Geber, which is near Eilat, which is on the Gulf of Aqaba, sent ships, Shlomo sent ships through the Arabian Sea to Ophir. Therefore, the trading pact between Hiram and Shlomo was mutually expedient. It worked out well for both men. How so? Shlomo was benefited from Hiram's experience in Hiram's trading with Carthage, because Hiram was the main man at Tyre, and he had this, as we said a moment ago, he had this relationship of trading with Carthage. So King Shlomo benefited from that. And how did Hiram benefit from Solomon? What did he gain from Shlomo? Hiram gained access to Asia via Shlomo's port all the way in the south of Israel in Etzion Gever. So Hiram was able to utilize that port and do trading in Asia to the east of Israel. That's Asia, obviously. So he was able to get over there and do some trading. Yeah.
What confuses me is Lebanon was on the coast north of Israel.
Oh, yeah.
And is it? Maybe it might. Yeah, I'm not great at geography, so maybe my geography's all screwed up. But I would think that would be more accessible to Asia than the Gulf of Aqaba would be closer to Africa.
What did Asia mean in this context?
What did Asia mean? I would think anything east of Israel.
What source were you reading to use the word Asia?
You know what? That's a great question. Because I'm reading a very long paragraph, and there seems to be no attribution to it.
Because in terms of Asia and Africa, both were used by Chazal to mean not necessarily the continents that we know by those names. It may have been areas of those continents. Just for example, the famous Totafos and Shema, right? That's right, Jerash. Zavgat Hatzvah, exactly. Two and two. You need four partials, right? So the Tatarfat is means two in a language Chazal called Afriki, which most simply seems to say African. What language in Africa is African, right? Okay, the word Asia, you have a term in English, Asia Minor. So at different times, right, those terms were used indeed geographically, but not necessarily to mean what they mean in more recent times.
Indeed. Which may be why we have Kush and Ophir in Asia, meaning
right.
What we would consider Africa, and that would explain how Aqaba makes it more accessible.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm just thinking that, I guess maybe we could pull up a map of ancient Israel. Wouldn't we see the south of Israel? No, this map is not going to do it for us. But let me just think. Israel, Eilat, Etzion Gever, that whole area over there. Excuse me. Isn't it the case that it leaves out, isn't there a waterway that leads out into about the Indian Ocean or something that leads into the Indian Ocean, that area. And then south of that is the Arabian Peninsula. Without a map in front of me, I'm just kind of conjecturing over here, and I don't want to do that.
Do you have a map that covers something?
No.
Yeah, but the map that we have is not
Israel.
It doesn't take us all the way to the south. It just gives you a little bit of Israel. This map that we're talking about is not really good enough because we'd like to go further south over here and see Eilat at Tzion Gever and see where the waterways lead to. Unfortunately, this map does not provide that. At all events, we're told, and we should take it, I guess, on faith that Hiram benefited greatly from his relationship with Shlomo, but Shlomo enabled him to have this port in Eilat / Etzion Geber. That enabled him to send his ships out into what we're told Asia. Rabbi Berla, were you saying a moment ago that Chazal were equating Asia and Africa? They're interchangeable?
No, at all. I was simply saying that the terms Asia and Africa did not necessarily take in what we know as the continents of those names, but they took in perhaps more limited areas that might have been part of the continent. One would have to trace even beyond Chazal in general history. What did those geographical place names, what did they mean in the, you know, in the ancient times or in the late ancient times?
Yeah. Okay. As you guys go on your phones to check that very question out, we're going to keep on going. Moreover, Shlomo's merchants were inexperienced in navigation, we're told. According to this idea, King Shlomo had men, and they didn't have much experience in navigation. Hiram's sailors attended to the sailing of the ships. Those sailors did have experience in navigation, and so there was that relationship as well that worked out well for Shlomo and his men. And Hiram's sailors arrived from Tarshish only once in 3 years. They remained in Tarshish there to gather cargo to bring back with them. So they would spend ample amount of time in Tarshish gathering all kinds of monkeys pelicans or peacocks. And they would come back to the land of Israel once every 3 years. The Abarbanel mentions that in 1 Kings chapter 22, there is mention that Jehoshaphat constructed ships of Tarshish to go to Ophir, but they were broken in Etzion Geber. And this means, and we go over to page 117, little e, this means that the technical construction of the ships was similar to the ships of Tarshish. However, the destination of the fleet was Ophir. Hence, they embarked from Etzion Geber, all the way in the south of Israel, which is on the Gulf of Aqaba, and they proceeded to the Reed Sea. Now, in Divrei Hayamim, in the biblical book known as Chronicles, the chronicler states in 2 Chronicles chapter 20 that Jehoshaphat sent ships to Tarshish, and they embarked from Etzion Geber. So which is it? Did they embark from Etzion Geber and go to Tarshish, as it says in Chronicles, or did they go to Ophir from Etzion Geber? Well, that's a good question. Since Tarshish was on the Mediterranean, it is impossible to reach there from Etzion Geber. The Abarbanel therefore theorizes that since Jehoshaphat had no alliance with Tyre, with the city of Tyre, T-Y-R-E, a relationship and alliance which Shlomo had maintained, but Jehoshaphat did not. Therefore, Jehoshaphat had no port suitable for shipbuilding. His ships embarked therefore from Etzion Gever and traveled up a branch of the Nile River. Nile River. When he got to shallow water, the ships ran aground and they were broken. And that explains why later on in our Book of Kings, chapter 22, we're going to read about broken ships in Etzion Gever.
I think that this is the Gulf of...
Okay, Mrs. Brother's going to show us a map on her phone to see if that sheds some light. By the way, the editor's note is that this is similar to the route going through the Reed Sea and the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean Sea.
Right, I think this is the Gulf of Aqaba here, I think, that goes into the Arabian Sea and around, and there's the Red Sea, which takes you over by Africa.
Mm-hmm.
See, and that's how they got to Africa, whereas Asia was on the other side. The Mediterranean Sea wouldn't. So they could get that way to, there's Kush. You could get to Ethiopia, to other areas, and from here you could get to the upper part.
You know, you gotta just, people who are calling in, you gotta just, you know, you gotta see it to believe it, and I'm sorry you can't see it. This is why we should be Skyping this or doing this over the web or something. We have a map over here. Mrs. Burloff has provided it. If I could just have a look at it, I'll give it a shot. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can try to make some sense out of it, if possible. All right, let's just see. There's Israel, and there is the south of Israel, and the south of Israel leads into the body of water that we know as the Yam Suf, the Reed Sea.
No, it's the Gulf of Aqaba.
Well, here's the Reed Sea.
Right.
Israel, the port of
right.
Eilat would lead into the Reed Sea, which then itself would lead into the Gulf of Aqaba.
According to what I saw before, though, because you can't even really see Israel. Here, Israel's right over there. They don't even have it.
Okay.
There, the Gulf of Aqaba.
I think you have it in the lower right-hand corner over there, right? Is that the Gulf of Aqaba?
No, this is the Persian Gulf. So
okay.
Maybe it's this little thing over here. I don't know,
possibly.
Because I had another map.
Oh, pretty sure also to our friends.
Because when I had it before, here's the Gulf of Aqaba there.
Uh-huh.
See, and then I had another map, where if I can get back to where I was. No, that's not it. There was one where you could see that the Gulf of Aqaba went around, and then there was the Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was trying to get to.
Okay. Mr. Bill, can I ask you to please show it to our friends?
Yeah, I'll let you see it too. Okay. So
thank you.
So here's the lot, which is by the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, I can't find the one that I had before, which shows that the Gulf of Aqaba is going into the Red Sea. I didn't find that clearly we have the Gulf of Aqaba at the end of it. Down by
right, right.
You can see
clearly. Do you lads want a snack, by the way? Anybody want a snack? As Mrs. Burloff is showing off the maps, and I want to thank you very much for that, Mrs. Burloff. We're going to continue to get confused as we continue on. We'll read the Malbim now. In English, Malbim differs with this. He identifies Tarshish with Tartessus, the most ancient colony of the Phoenicians in Spain, which was the center of commerce for them. So for the Malbim, when he hears the word Tarshish, he thinks Spain. Spain's far out there. If you guys know your geography, you know... If you get on a boat from Israel, and you start going west, you're going to go past Cyprus, you're going to go past the Italian boot, then you're going to go through from Cyprus to Greece, you're going to go through the islands of Greece, then you're going to keep on going west, going to hit Italy, then you keep on going and going, and eventually you hit Spain, and boy, that's a lot of traveling.
So here you have the Gulf of Aqaba, goes into the Red Sea, and then there you have the Suez Canal.
Oh, let me see that. Thank you. Gulf of Aqaba, and it looks like, if I'm not mistaken, let me just see, the Gulf of Aqaba has got a lot at the very top,
right.
And the Gulf of Aqaba feeds into the Reed Sea, and on the right-hand side of the Reed Sea is Saudi Arabia, contemporary Saudi Arabia, and on the left, well, that's the Sinai Peninsula, which is, of course, Egyptian territory now. But it's not Egypt proper. It's not classical Egypt. At least I don't want to term it that. I mean, Egypt is in charge of it now. Israel gave it back to them. So it's Egyptian property. On your left of the Gulf of Aqaba is Egypt. On your right of the Gulf of Aqaba is Saudi Arabia. At the very top of the Gulf of Aqaba is the Israeli city of Eilat. And the Gulf of Aqaba comes down and feeds into the Reed Sea.
And then the Gulf of Suez,
Is on the left-hand side, and that runs up the side of the Sinai Peninsula on its left-hand side. So for the Sinai Peninsula, you've got the Gulf of Suez on the left and the Gulf of Aqaba on the right, and the pool on the bottom is the Reed Sea. So that sheds a lot of light. I mean, that's clarifying things a little bit. Thank you very much. Please share with our fellow classmates. Thank you so much, Mrs. Brewer, for that. That's good. I think that's very helpful. At least now we kind of have an idea, sort of, about things, and that's good. At all events, again, for the Malbim, he's equating Tarshish with Tartessus, the most ancient colony of the Phoenicians in Spain, which was a center of commerce for them. Therefore, Shlomo collaborated with Hiram in his dealings with Spain. Wow. Malbim also adds that gold was found in Ophir, which is in the torrid zone, the hot zone, whereas silver was located in Spain, which is in the temperate zone. I always got the impression that Spain was a pretty warm country, being a Mediterranean country, and being located where it is, it gets a lot of sunshine, and it's fairly warm. But I guess it's not considered being in the super hot zone.
Which, again, is it Malbim?
Yeah, Malbim.
The Malbim, what Malbim was operating was a 19th century. I'm not saying only 19th century, because I was limited to those kind of years. Concept of very, very firm zones in the, you see the old maps, they have the torrid zone and moderate zone, and the torrid zone they have, I think, picture of what the devil or something, the fire and the west. So he had some very specific ideas of the magnetic demarcation between zones that required. It's such a contemporary.
I didn't know that. I had no idea. I've never heard of the torrid zone and the temperate zone. So that's very, very good. Thank you, Verbal, for that. That clarifies a bit. He further theorizes, the Malbim does, that Yehoshaphat's ships were constructed in Etzion Gever, which is in the very south, as we said, of Israel, right next door to contemporary Eilat. Okay, and Yehoshaphat, a later king in Israel, or in Judah, Yehoshaphat's ships were constructed in Etzion Gever to journey both to Ophir and Tarshish.
No, we don't know how.
Okay. This reconciles this discrepancy between the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles. According to this theory of the Malbim, that king's ships were constructed in the south of Israel, and they were journeying both to Ophir and Tarshish. And Tarshish, again, for the Malbim, is way out in Spain. Since Yehoshaphat had become allied with Ahaziah, king of Israel, about whom Scripture states, He did what was bad in God's eyes. See 1 Kings chapter 22, right here in our Sefer. We'll get to it eventually. Ahaziah did bad stuff in Hashem's eyes. So because Jehoshaphat was allied with that bad king, Hashem punished Jehoshaphat, and his ships were broken. And see 2 Chronicles chapter 20 for that discussion over there. And that explains why his ships were broken. God was punishing him for being an ally of a very bad king. We continue. Says the rabbis who are the authors of the Sefer, the editors of the Sefer, Rabbi Reuben Hochberg and Rabbi Rosenberg, he or they write, both theories seem unlikely. Abarbanel's theory is questioned by the Kli Yakar on a number of points. Number one, it is unlikely that Jehoshaphat had no port in which to build ships except for Etzion Geber. After all, Yafo was known as a port when? Where do we see the city of Yafo make an appearance in biblical times? What prophet went down to Yafo in order to get a boat, in order to run away from God? Hashem wanted to talk to him and put him over to Nineveh. And this Navi says, I don't think I want to do that. So he goes down to Yafo. Now, what's going on in Yafo?
To where?
Okay, he's going to go to Tarshish, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, on that. Boys, do we know the name of that prophet?
Jonah.
That's exactly right. Jonah was indeed the name of that prophet. Very good. So Jonah went to Yafo. So you see over here that even in biblical times, in ancient times, Yafo was right there on the coast, a very busy port. Ships were going back and forth, ship back and forth. And indeed, he got on a ship to go to Tarshish. I would have thought that means Tarsus in Asia Minor, which is now contemporary Turkey. But according to our rabbis, that, according to the Malbim anyway, Tarshish is all the way off in Spain. Now, that would have been quite an undertaking. I mean, because it would take a very long time to go to Spain. To go to Tarsus in Asia Minor, in Turkey, not that long. At all events, just bank these ideas in your head.
It's on the Mediterranean.
Well, yes, in the northern Mediterranean of a sort, straight up to go to Turkey, maybe 200-300 miles north of Israel, straight up in the Mediterranean. There's Tarsus of the first century, of the contemporary times, 2,000 years ago. And if you want to peel it back, goodness, if you want to say, according to Malbim, that Tarsus was off in Spain, that was like almost 1,000 years earlier, almost a full 1,000 years earlier in Jonah's time. I mean, maybe not 1,000. Shave a little bit, shave half of that. Shave 500 or 600 years before. Okay, either way, I'm just trying to guesstimate it. The Kli Yakar is saying, listen, Jehoshaphat, come on. It's not like he didn't have any other port to build a ship except for Etzion Geber. Sure he did. Yafo was known as a port in the times of Jonah. Now, Jonah lived a little bit later than now, than what we're talking about. He lived a little bit later, but maybe not much later. Why could it not be used for shipbuilding and embark? When did Jonah live? Well, in times of Bavel, when he was sent to Nineveh in Asher. Okay, so he was sent to Nineveh in Asher to prophesy against them. And wasn't he as a member of the Shneimar, of the Treasar? So that was, I would have thought that's like at the tail end of, am I wrong? The tail end of the first century, of the first temple. Whew. Okay. So Yafo was known as a port in the times of Jonah, but that's a little bit later than right now, Solomon's time. But at all events, even if it's known in the times of Jonah, maybe it was also developing into a port in the times of Solomon. Why couldn't it be used for shipbuilding and embarking on Mediterranean voyages? Good question. Maybe it was a little bit before Jonah's, in the Jonah's time. Maybe that's the reason why it wasn't used. Not so sure how to answer that decent question. But those familiar with the region know very well that the branches of the Nile River are not deep enough for navigation. In addition to these questions, it is difficult to understand why the ships were broken in Etzion Geber rather than somewhere along the Nile River. Well, all right, but what can we say? The mountain had his, had a cosmic godly reason why the ships were broken, because he was alive with a bad guy.
That was a Barbanel. Funny, is it? That was a Barbanel theory. Now he's going to take
exception
to Mabit.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the quick correction on that. Malbim's theory is likewise difficult. We read over here in the footnote, it is unlikely, he writes, that Shlomo would send ships around the Cape of Good Hope to reach Spain. Now, the Cape of Good Hope is the very, very bottom of South Africa, is it not? I mean, that is about as far south as a human being can go, going around South Africa without hitting Antarctica. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating, but South Africa is so south. It is like 2,000 miles along the coastline of the African continent. Now, who in the world is going to send a ship all the way south, hugging the African continent, and then hook around contemporary South Africa, Cape of Good Hope, and then come up another 2,000 miles on the left side to get to Spain? Wow, why would you do that if all you got to do is just stay on the Mediterranean Sea and go straight past Cyprus, like I said, past Greece, past Italy, and you eventually get to Spain? What is this talk about South Africa? I'm not sure I'm even copying that. It seems unlikely that Shlomo would send ships around the Cape of Good Hope to reach Spain. I would agree with that. It is unlikely that he would do that. Did he know the maps of the day? He knew about Africa and how big it was and the Cape of Good Hope. And you come around and you get to Spain, and then you're on the Atlantic Ocean on that side of things. What? I mean, I don't get it.
It's arguing that it's the only port you have is Eilat. You got to go down and around.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right. Eilat does not lend itself out as a port onto the Mediterranean Sea. It just doesn't go there. It goes into the Gulf of Aqaba, leading into the Reed Sea, and then you could take it down, is that the Southern Atlantic or the Indian Ocean or something, and then you're just suddenly in this big body of water and you're hugging the African coast all the way down. I see what you're saying. So in theory, that's possible now, but he's throwing cold water on it and saying it is not very likely that Shlomo would have done that he would have sent ships around the Cape of Good Hope, bottom of South Africa, in order to reach Spain. Or even if Shlomo did not do so, it is unlikely, he says, that Jehoshaphat should have done so instead of sending ships from Yafo, which is, of course, a port right on the Mediterranean, which gives you easy access to Greece, Italy, and then on to Spain.
Solomon wouldn't need to because he had his agreement with Hiram.
To be able to utilize Hiram's tire, the city of Tyre, which is right there in the Mediterranean Sea. As we see right over here, I think, and this is one good thing about the map that we do have. This map does indeed give us some help. Here is ancient Israel, maybe not all of it, but a good chunk of it. And here's contemporary Jordan on your right-hand side. Okay, everybody? And over here, way north in contemporary Lebanon, there is a city known as Tyre, is right there on the Mediterranean Sea. Go a little bit south, you're in Akko, and keep on going south, and you get to Yafo, which is not that far from contemporary Bnei Brak and Tel Aviv. So Yafo is it's in the heart of things in Israel today, and Akko is way north near Haifa, the contemporary Haifa. And Tyre is solidly in contemporary Lebanon. And all these three towns have access to the Mediterranean Sea. But Eilat does not. Eilat, all the way down over here where my finger is, cannot access the Mediterranean Sea. Rather, it goes into the Gulf of Aqaba and then theoretically into the sides of Africa, and we're being told that it's unlikely that he would have sent anything that way. It is therefore more probable, we continue, that the theory offered by the Kliyukah is the most accurate. The Kliyukah suggests that Jehoshaphat built ships in two ports. Those ships destined to go to Tarshish were built in Yaffa. Okay? Ships that were built, that were bound to go to Tarshish, whether it's in Asia Minor in Turkey over here, or all the way out in Spain over here, well, they're going to be built over here in Yaffa, right there, and they have easy access to the Mediterranean Sea. They're right on the sea. Okay?
It's the Tel Aviv Spanish line, huh?
Yes, exactly. It's the Tel Aviv Spanish line. I like that. So you have that, and those destined to go to Ophir were built in Etzion Gever. And weren't we told that Ophir, where was Ophir? Through the Arabian Sea to Ophir.
East of Kush.
East of Kush, somewhere in contemporary Asia.
Most likely Africa.
Uh-huh. Okay. At all events, those ships destined to go to Ophir were built in Etzion Gever in the south of Israel, near Eilat, right on the Gulf of Aqaba. So they had that at port to be able to utilize. In fulfillment of the prophet's admonition, the ships, where am I? The ships that had been built in Etzion Gever were broken. Therefore, Jehoshaphat refrained from continuing on his venture, and he did not complete those ships being constructed in Yaffa. Ships were destroyed in Etzion Gever, and therefore, because of that, he recognized why he's getting punished, and he therefore stopped building ships in Jaffa, in Yaffa, on the Mediterranean. There is, however, no proof that Tarshish was Carthage, in which he concurs with Abarbanel. The Kliyukah agrees with the Abarbanel that Tarshish was Carthage. It may just as likely have been Spain. Indeed, in Mishnaic times, a voyage to Spain took a whole year. See Baba Basra, chapter 3, Mishnah 1. It is very likely that in biblical times, the voyage took longer. This would account for the fact that the ships of Tarshish arrived once in 3 years. If Tarshish is out in Spain and not in Carthage, North Africa, not in Tarsus, as we know that city in first century, it came into the Western consciousness in the first century, in Asia Minor / Turkey. No, it's not that either. Oh, no, we're being told that Tarshish is Tartarus or Tartessus, and it's in Spain. Well, it takes a very long time to get to Spain as you travel along the Mediterranean Sea in biblical times, and that does make some sense now to tell me that ships would come from there, Spain, once every 3 years back to Israeli, you know, Eretz Israel ports. Well, that's really something.
I'm very skeptical about those long times. The travel was much longer, but let's not forget the Roman Empire. Now, it's true that was not at this time, but, I mean, Rome obviously had to get control of, not to our, no, as we say, law later, not to our happiness, or to Israel. They had control of Spain, and I don't believe it took them a year.
Well, but then again, they probably weren't starting out from Spain either.
Yeah, I don't believe it took a half a year from Spain to Rome. I don't believe it took a half a year from Rome to Israel, because then anything that they would do, let's say, to reinforce their control, you have to double that, right? Let's say there'd be trouble, rebellion in any of those places. It would take one One to get word back to Rome, and then to get Rome back to the.
Did they have territory in Africa?
Rome?
I think so, but I don't know.
So, you know, they could have headquarters there, which is a lot closer to Israel.
Possible, right. I just think that it's really exaggerated.
Maybe, but let's remember that we're talking about really ancient times over here. Isn't it fair to say that some of those ships may not have been the world's greatest, and they were with sails? Maybe they didn't have a whole lot of men with oars. They're dealing with the Mediterranean Sea, which might have been a challenge to navigate.
How long did it take to get three steamboats, or sailing ships, when they settled to America in the early years? And there was just... And that, I think of the distance there.
Spain is pretty far from Israel.
One second. What's that?
Yeah.
You're trying to compare ships from the first century
to ships that are actually 500 years before.
And ships of 1492 to ships that were... I don't know how many hundred before CE?
Right, 300 or 400 years before the first century.
They're probably less developed.
I'm not angry, but I don't think that I don't know.
It could very well be. It could be that they hadn't figured out, hey, if we put up more sails, you know, or whatever.
But they moved the whole coastline. How did you move the sails to?
Yeah, but we don't know when they developed that Kufma.
True, but
it's hard to know. And to say that Tarsus is in Spain, but, you know, at least it makes some sense that it takes that long. We're trying to get a shot, an understanding as to why a ship would come in only once every 3 years. If the ship was coming in from Tarsus of the first century in Turkey, it doesn't take 3 years to go from Tarsus, Asia Minor, down to Israel. That's a three-week process, or a month, or 2 months, whatever, max. But Spain is so far out there, and maybe you got to hug some coasts, and just in case you're at sea and you don't want to capsize. So maybe they're hugging the coast along the way in ancient times. Maybe they're really going very slowly.
And probably make stops along the way.
I'm thinking maybe that also might be the case. You stop off in contemporary France. You stop off.
Well, but then France is in the way.
Well, you can stop off. You can, yeah, France. Juts down, the southern part of France juts down a little bit where Nice is, I think, and you're able to stop if you needed to.
You stop in a few countries
and
along the way.
That's what they were doing. They were making money, they were traveling, they were selling, they were buying. They were doing stuff.
Getting provisions.
Yeah, in ancient times you had to hug the coast. Otherwise you're at the mercy of God in the open waters. Maybe they just didn't want to do that. So this way, they stop every 10 miles, they stop. You unload, you make a sale. That would make some sense to me. That it would just take forever. In ancient times, it would just take forever. That's what I got.
You don't have just open sea like the whole Atlantic.
Right, and you got Italy. You want to stop off in Italy. You want to stop off in Greece. So there are places to stop off in the Mediterranean, and you're doing all that, and you're taking on products and stuff. And now, I never thought that Tarsus could be out in Spain. It never occurred to me. But I never thought of it because they're saying, oh, it's in Spain. Now, that would explain a three-year trip. That's about all I got on that. I'll for the last word.
If Tarsus comes out in English, it's Tarsus.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, but if that's the case, when they talk about, you know, the Christian leader, Paul, Tarsus, are you aware that Tarsus was?
That's exactly what I was saying. In the first century, when I'm saying things like first century, I'm alluding to Saul of Tarsus, Asia Minor, which is in contemporary Turkey.
Oh, I see. Right.
Southern coast of contemporary Turkey Tarsus.
Which may or may
not still around.
Right.
And that entered the Western consciousness through Saul. And that's Tarsus that you and I are familiar with. Mm-hmm. We are not familiar with an even more ancient Tarsus or Tarshish, which we're told, according to some rabbis, is off in Spain. That's thousands of miles west. And yet that would make some sense now that you're telling me that it's a three-year journey. That makes a little bit of sense. A three-year journey, Taka, makes some sense. From Spain to Israel would take forever, wouldn't it? It's a long trip. And you're stopping off along the way to get provisions and let people buy and sell and disembark and do their thing. That's what people do.
And here, when I Googled where it was Tarshish and it was talking about Jonah,
okay,
they put it in Spain.
They put it in Spain. Well, then that is another, I don't know if it clinches it, but that certainly is a super addition to the idea that suddenly Tarshish is off in a faraway place called España. Spain.
I have to leave you.
I went to. Thank you very, very much, everybody. We are done. Yisr Koyach. We're back in business. Baruch Hashem, Shavuos uplifted us. We continue learning Torah. Mr. Hashem, please join us next week for more Melachim Aleph, First Kings. Next week, God willing, we're going to try to conclude the chapter of chapter 10. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great and uplifting week. Thank you, sir. Kol tov. Bye-bye.